Welcome to Credit Exchange, your podcast for all things credit, where we speak to the biggest newsmakers and news shapers in finance. I'm your host, Lisa Lee. This week, my guest is Mark Jenkins, co-president and head of credit insurance at Carlyle, one of the premier alternative asset managers with nearly $500 billion in AUM. Welcome, Mark.
Hi, Lisa. Thanks for having me today.
Mark, even as I was prepping for this podcast earlier today, I was going to start by asking you about gold and silver, the staggering route we saw at the end of last week. But now, already, that's moderated, and equity markets have rallied to start this week, February 2nd as we tape. Is that because we got some good data on corporates? And if so, how have they held up so well?
Yeah, I think we've seen a lot of positive data in our own portfolio. I would say it feels like the U.S. economy is running pretty well, maybe even pretty hot. I think our view is that you've got annualized GDP running around 3%. So that's pretty strong. Corporate growth, corporate earnings have been really good. You've seen a lot of spending, across kind of the spectrum. But I think what's happened is you've had a lot of IT departments have been emboldened to find out what their AI strategy is going to be. And there's a big spend there that's also supporting all the spend that we're seeing in AI more generally. So that's cascading through the economy. And right now we're seeing pretty strong growth in our corporate, the corporate names that we cover, both on the private equity side and on the credit side.
That's quite amazing, given everything, how strong the economy has performed throughout last year and it was expected this year. To the point, there might be actually some fears that the economy might run too hot. Now, over the weekend, President Donald Trump selected the next Federal Reserve Chairman, Ken Walsh. And he's always been sort of known as a hawk, even though President Trump definitely wants interest rates to be lower. Can you give me your thoughts on this selection and then the Federal Reserve independence in total?
Yeah, I don't know if I can speak much to the independence. I'll leave that to the president, the judiciary, and the executive branch, I guess. But what I would say is a couple of things. One is, going into the balance of this year, we're going to see some pretty substantial tax stimulus go through, right? You're going to see refunds that are probably in the area of, 60 to 80 billion. So that's going to cascade through the system. I've already talked about the strong growth that we're seeing in our portfolio so far. So the incoming Fed governor is going to have some challenges, I think, as it relates to, watching, the inflation level with that type of growth, but also the fact that I'm sure the president didn't ask him to be the Fed governor if he said he wasn't willing to cut rates. So I think the market expectation still is you'll probably see a couple cuts this year. Whether that's warranted or not, not for me to say. But if you add that into the mix from an investment perspective, I think what you could see is, you're right, the economy could continue to run relatively, robustly, let's say. And the question is, what happens going into 2027? Do we have some inflationary impact from that? And do we have some inflationary impact from what we're seeing as tariffs kind of work their way through? Now, his argument, I think, has been that it's a one-time effect, but it's unclear at this point in time. So we won't know probably for another 12 to 24 months.
That's interesting. So in your estimation, we'll have strong growth. Markets should perform well. And if we do see inflation starting to really rear its head or get out of control the way it was a couple of years back, it won't really happen until 2027. So this is not a this year, short-term, even immediate-term problem, but something a little bit later.
Yeah, I'm not good at predicting where inflation is going to go or when it's going to happen, but I would think that it'll take a while to work itself through. But nonetheless, I think what it means from an investment perspective is we can feel relatively decent about, the environment going forward for the next 12 months. The question is, into 27, 28, what does that environment look like? And then, of course, you have to overlay, a lot of the money that's going into AI, what we haven't seen yet come through, but we expect, obviously, and I'm sure the incoming governor is expecting, is some productivity gains from that, right? Everybody is being asked to consider, ourselves included, how can you use AI to be more productive, right?
Yeah. So let's really delve down into artificial intelligence. Because, Mark, you are one of the first guys in finance to really talk to me about AI and definitely the very first credit guy to talk to me about AI. And I have to admit, I didn't quite follow you when you started to tell me about how much AI was going to impact the workforce and productivity gains that we should expect. But so much of what you've said has proved to be prescient. So I want to tackle AI with you. So let's get into it. How much productivity are you expecting? What's your thoughts?
Yeah, I think, well, from productivity, it really gets down to implementation. And I think we have this great tool out there called AI, and we haven't 100% figured out how to implement it yet. So the next stage is going to be how do corporates implement AI into their workflows. And I think that process is really in the first innings of implementation. Because one, the traditional consulting firms, you know, they haven't been expert, if you will, although they may say they are, in implementing it. And then the actual, you know, if you think about OpenAI, Anthropic, and many others that developed the actual models, that hasn't been their first order, workflow is to develop how you implement it. It's really developing AI itself. And so I think that's coming together right now. And so I really believe that's going to take, you know, not years, but several months to start to eat into the system. And as we're all learning, ourselves included here at Carlisle, is how can you implement things to be efficient? So to give you a precise, like, hey, how efficient are we going to be? I mean, I have heard some estimates where people are actually reducing significant parts of their business because AI has effectively, or large language models have taken over the skill set. So I recently heard on a call, somebody eliminated 80% of their compliance department.
Oh, wow.
Because 80% of that work was really scanning through documents to see if it was in compliance with certain things within their organization. So you could see significant gains like that occurring, but it's how quickly are organizations willing to turn to it, and how can you get the resources to help you do it? So I think that's number one. I think the other thing people need to recognize is a massive build out in compute is still ongoing. And when you talk to the large providers, that's their number one concern is the amount of compute that they have. So how does that impact workflows as well?
And how about how that impacts the labor market? Because that has been one of the reasons why the Federal Reserve has cut, although they held steady the last time, because the labor market has been weak. Should we expect more labor weakness? Should we expect sort of this market that doesn't seem to fire, but neither hire?
Yeah, you know, I don't know if I'm the best person to like kind of give you a view on that one. I think what I would say with the resources that people have, they should be able to achieve more if you implement AI. That's for certain. I think there are certain business models that are just going to have to change, because AI will take over vast swaths of what you usually did with humans, but those people may be redeployed and doing other value-added things. So if you think about the business that we do, there's a lot of what I would call kind of rote type work that we have to do to get models in place, to get data in place, that now AI can go into a data room for us, scrape thousands of documents, assemble them in a very, you know, thoughtful, organized way, so that then we can spend time actually thinking through, you know, what those documents are telling us, as opposed to spending a lot of time organizing so we can actually analyze it. So that's made us way more efficient. And I will tell you, we're able here at Carlisle to look at a lot more opportunities as a result of that. I can see the workflow has gone up dramatically. I'll give you an example. It used to take about 6 to 7 hours for some of our associates to do screening memos, you know, first time looks at things. And today, by using AI and large language models, and we've got the right data lakes in place, we can cut that down to about an hour. And so what does that mean? It means we can look at more opportunities, and then those associates can spend more time doing value-added work, analysis, et cetera, that they weren't ordinarily doing, where they're trying to pull various data sources together to get the information to us to make a decision.
So have you already seen like higher quality work from your employees? When they come to you, it takes them a shorter time, and then when they do it, it's better quality. You're like, yes, already. Or is it, do you think it still takes a little bit time to play out yet?
I think what it means is, because we have more flowing through our pipes, we can screen a broader set of opportunity, which by definition should allow us to make better decisions and actually have higher quality origination at the end of the day.
So you're co-president of Carlisle. So how are you guys in this, as a leadership, thinking about how Carlyle should use AI. You've given one example, but you as a firm have to have a strategy and a way to tackle both how it's going to, how you can use it, harness it, but also in what ways you might have to counter against it, right? Because there's both good and bad.
Yeah. So we have a pretty robust approach to it. We obviously have a head of our chief technology officer, who she runs a very focused approach to that, which is, you know, not just in all technology, but how do we use AI to be much more efficient in the various areas where we have a lot of workflow that can be, you know, skinny down, if you will, and made more refined, if you will. And I think, you know, that is ongoing. We are constantly thinking about that. The people that are, you know, at the coalface, if you will, are being encouraged to think about how can we use AI to make ourselves more efficient. But that's really being driven at the top level by our CTO. Away from that, you know, we have a team that works with the investment groups as to how can we think through using AI to help us make better investment decisions, right? Not just the processing, not like just building the models, but what can AI do for us to glean things that we couldn't see ourselves or just couldn't consume that much data? And I think to me, that's the that's kind of the fascinating thing that's going on with AI right now, that we're using in credit, we're using in private equity, we're using in funds and secondaries in our Help Invest group to make us more efficient, but also look at massive amounts of data and consume it in a much more thoughtful way that would be very difficult to do, quite frankly, without the use of these models. And so what does that mean, right? It means that we can detect things sometimes that allow us to pass on investments that we might have proceeded on because at the higher level, we couldn't get the granularity that was really necessary. And I'm thinking of things where there's, you know, large amounts of data that we need to pursue downstream to figure out how various inputs go into a product, let's say. And in some cases, what we've been able to detect is that, you know, the products that we thought were going downstream into products that would continue on are actually going into products that are going out of, you know, kind of next generation are going to be replaced. And that's allowed us to kind of back away and say, okay, how are we going to value that company? So I think there's a lot of things that I've seen so far from our teams that have told us, you know, using AI appropriately, it's not going to make the decision for you. It certainly is going to reveal things that are going to change or shape the way you make the decision and certainly how you price risk when you make an investment.
When you talk about AI, how about some of the delusion that AI causes, right? Like, how do you mitigate for that? Because I was talking to someone who's very involved with AI, and he said that's a feature, not a bug. So it's not something you can get rid of. Something you have to live with is that it can hallucinate and become delusional.
Well, I'm not the expert in this, but I would say what the teams tell me is that we're able to create, you know, agents, separate agents who can look at the data from different angles and sort of minimize the ability for you to hallucinate or at least check the work of one other agent that's doing work for you. I mean, you know, we probably could do a whole different podcast. You probably should have somebody else on other than me, but the little I've learned about it and the amount of processing capability at different levels you're able to do with different agents all simultaneously, which we typically used to have to keep in our head, it's actually quite extraordinary.
But I think it's fascinating talking to you is you are someone, a decision maker at Carlyle. And how are decision makers such as yourselves implementing AI and understanding AI to me is as fascinating as talking to someone who's doing AI right now.
Yeah. And I think if you don't embrace it, I mean, it's a reality. And I, you know, by the things I've just doing on my own recently, like,
I want to know what you've been doing on your own. Some of the guys I talk to have been making little videos.
Okay. Well, what I did recently on my own is 2 weekends ago, I downloaded, I have Claude personally, and I downloaded Claude Code, and I made a website. And I don't know how to code, but I made a website in 20 minutes. One that would show me, which in fact, I think I've told you this, my wife has a nonprofit for financial literacy. She has her website she's paid money for, and I made a mock-up of one in about 20 minutes that would replicate a lot of the things that that website does. this past weekend, I used some Google technology to basically create reports to give me a better understanding of some subject matter. And what it does is it allows you to input multiple sources of input, plus using other things like, you know, I'm using lots of names, Perplexity, to create research reports and input that, and then create overall reports, create a slideshow, create like a podcast. I mean, look, I think it's pretty interesting what it's able to do, and at least gives you a base level understanding of things. But the ability to accumulate knowledge and information and then sort it and then read through it and then question it and then look at the sources is pretty powerful. And these tools are available to everybody right now.
And that's why I find it so fascinating that you are spending your time, because you're running Cardot. That's a full-time job. And yet at the same time, you are testing out these new applications and playing with them yourself. Is that what you would recommend people junior to do and other people in the market? Learn to do this. Touch this.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I do this on my weekends, my free time. But anyway, I think that how we have embraced AI and technology is to say, look, we need to get to the base level, ground level, and have people incorporate it into their everyday and feel comfortable with it, because, you know, it is going to evolve. So there's no like one point in time when you have to jump in. You might as well jump in now. And as it evolves, you're going to become more comfortable using it and more comfortable with, you know, what the processes are, and more comfortable trying to understand how AI works. Because part of it is, when you do, you said it, like sometimes you look at the output and you want to, you know, should you believe it or not, you need to understand how that output happened. Because sometimes, it's like us, we make mistakes, so does AI. And so you got to embrace the fact it makes mistakes and then try to make it better, if you will.
Change is exciting, but for some people, it can be scary too. And there's a lot of, you probably have staff, even at Carlisle and everywhere we go, who are scared of AI and what it might do to their jobs, to what they know. How do you talk to them? How do you maybe console them? And what is going to be an inevitable change?
Well, I think in 35 years of my career, there's been nothing but change. I don't think it's been as dramatic as change as I've seen with, you know, in the past 3 years with AI, but there's definitely always been change. And I counsel people that those who are able to embrace it and then incorporate it into what they do, you know, typically are the ones who prosper. And so you shouldn't fear it, because change is inevitable. But if you embrace it and, you know, incorporate it into your daily life, then, you know, you're going to evolve with it, right? In a positive way, I think. You know, all the societal issues, et cetera, aside, those are different. I think those are different outside the workplace. But I think from a workplace perspective, you've got to embrace it. You've got to absorb it. And then you will evolve with that change for sure.
Okay. And thank you for that advice. And for our podcast listeners now getting advice for that you're giving to Carlisle employees. So I'm going to move away from that to just back to markets. Mark, are you afraid? Because the end of the day, I don't think has the same anything to do with perhaps with what AI can do in the future, but what presently the valuation of some of the AI firms, it is so high. And I know there's been a little bit of weakness here and there, but still, they're trading at incredible multiples. Are you worried about an AI bubble? And if so, what that might do to financial markets if there's a real retrenchment, even in equities? And I'll move on to credit markets next.
Yeah, I think the concern is, do we understand where all of the connectivity is to AI across your investment portfolio? So when I think about credit, right? So there's data centers, those are very easy to see. And we track that, we know what that is. Then it is software companies that will be impacted negatively by AI. And we saw that last week, as we saw, you know, especially in the credit markets, they were down 2 to 3 points in software names. And how much is that do you have in your portfolio? And then it's like downstream supplying to the AI market. What else is your exposure? And I think for us at Carlisle right now, we're spending a lot of time trying to understand that. And you know, the only way you can mitigate that is by diversifying away from it, at least in credit. And so that's exactly what we're doing. My concern, of course, is if you're overweighted in anything, like software, for instance, which we've seen recently, and there's a downturn, like that's a bad place to be. So for us in credit, you know, you've heard me say it very often, is, you know, diversity is the only thing that protects you through cycles. And I would go even further to say that, you know, diversity is the greatest indication of humility. The humility that you don't know what's going to happen in the market means you should diversify. And I think that's the approach we've taken. But it is hard to avoid because there is a disproportionate amount of allocation going to AI-related industries and software. And so you have to look at that in your overall portfolio. And then you say, okay, if you do have that exposure, are you exposed to high quality counterparties like Meta, you know, Microsoft, you know, Amazon, etc.? Or are you doing something that's not exposed to that, but you have some other underlying weaker credit? And I think that's where it turns, I think, for us right now, is identify the exposure, and then the exposure we have, what's the quality of that exposure?
We're going to get so much. There's a lot of enthusiasm for the data center financing. They seem to have almost an insatiable CapEx need. And they're now coming into debt markets, already tapped IG markets, or we've seen some high yield bond deals, and we're expected to get some leveraged loan deals upcoming. When you have that much money coming into the market, can you explain how do you select? You mentioned a little bit, you do select the names that you know, but there's so much coming. How much do you expect? And is that going to be too much for the market to actually digest?
Yeah, well, there'll be billions, like billions and billions. And I think what I would say is, A, you got first criteria number one is, what's your underlying credit counterparty? Like, who at the end of the day, when things go wrong, who are you facing? I think that's number one. Number two is, I wouldn't hurry, because in a market where you see a ton of like supply coming in, that's not a market where you have to worry, right? I mean, I think maybe in equity, you sometimes do that because you want to be early. I think in credit, if you see a huge amount of supply coming to the market, you can afford to be one choosier and way more patient. And frankly, you can be patient because if you do it all, you're going to be overweight AI. And I don't know if that's, from a credit perspective, a place you want to be.
So you heard it here, be patient and be picky. And then moving away from AI, we've had such a fun discussion about it. I want to know, where else are you interested in? What else? What's your top pick right now outside of AI debt and AI? What are you interested in? What are you looking at? What are you moving into?
I think right now where we see a lot of really interesting opportunity, continue to see good opportunity in Europe, whether that's on, you know, direct lending, European direct lending, or hybrid capital. You know, the growth there has not been tremendous compared to the US, but it hasn't been horrible. And there's certain areas where there's definitely growth and support. So I think that's a number one. Number two, opportunistic credit or hybrid capital has continued to be a very attractive place because there still are people looking for those bespoke, financing solutions. And I think for us, where we've typically had our strong suit is in non-sponsor deals, which is much more interesting. And that continues to be a good place for us as well. And then finally, you know, ABF, I know everybody talks about it. I think ABF, you know, as it relates to privately negotiated transactions, has continued to, you know, show good premium relative to the marketplace. And, you know, you have to pick your spots, but we're typically looking at areas where we're able to build a moat around the business, and the access to getting those loans has been, you know, complex and difficult. And anytime you can do that, you can create value for your investors.
On Europe, Europe doesn't have as much growth expectations and forecast as the US, but the corporates, they are sturdier. They seem to be, their balance sheets seem to be sturdier. And there has been this global play up to diversify more money into Europe. Why do you like European credit? Because reason one, reason two, or reason three?
Yeah, reason one is you've got a lot of well-capitalized companies in Europe still that have a global reach, right? So they're not just 100% tied to the EU from their investment or from their business perspective. So that's number one. So you can still access those companies, and they're good companies. Number two, there's technical reasons, if you will. You still have a relatively small amount of private credit relative to the syndicated loan market and the bank market relative to the United States. It's about one third. So there's still a long ways to go. And at the same time, you've got the local banks, or, you know, country related banks pulling back as well. And those are all creating good opportunities. So when I look at those companies on a risk adjusted basis, you're making an incremental 75 to 100 basis points, you know, relative to some U.S. companies. It's pretty interesting. And you can get diversity.
Okay. And so, pretty bullish picture, positive picture so far from Mark Jenkins on the U.S. economy, Europe. What's your worry? What's going to upend all this positive expectation and leave you in with a headache at the middle of this year?
Well, my worry is, I think, and we go back to AI, I think there's been a lot of money spent there. And it's a lot of equity dollars. So those dollars you don't worry about as much, only to the extent sentiment changes. And when sentiment changes, then, you know, you have a dislocation. And so my worry is, as it relates to AI and some of the interconnectedness of these companies, that once you have some negative sentiment in one area, it translates into other areas. And it will ripple through. I don't think it'll be a massive, you know, this isn't a GFC event, but this could be, you know, a dislocation event that's very sector oriented. And that could create opportunities, if you will, because it'll mean that capital will pull away from that space and there'll be opportunities. But I think, you know, that and really people getting too extended to it, right? Like we're talking about trying to be balanced and diverse. Not everybody's doing that. And so you could have, you know, funds, institutions, et cetera, that are, you know, heavily weighted towards that. And, you know, if there's an issue there, that could be a real problem. So
one thing we haven't talked about much, just a little bit, is tariffs. Is that sort of outside, not really a worry anymore? We've had them. Doesn't seem to be something maybe drastically different than what we know. Because for a while, that's all we spoke about, and now it's never brought up.
Yeah, well, I think what's happened is corporations, management teams have figured out how to either absorb them, you know, in their own cost structure, or pass them on to the consumer, and it's just become like a, you know, call it what it is, an inefficient tax, and so people have just absorbed it and they've moved on. I also think when anybody has said like there's these massive 100% tax, you know, tariffs going in place, they don't really ever seem to stick, and they tend to modulate around something that, you know, companies and consumers can generally absorb. It's, you know, it's not perfect, but so I think there's been a little bit of tariffs have kind of been put behind us and we're just moving on to other things.
How about geopolitical risk? Is that a big concern for you? Because already this year seems like it's hard to imagine it all happened in 1 month, but we had Venezuela, we had Iran, we had Greenland, we had the Davos speech, and yet market doesn't seem to care. And in some ways, I've forgotten what's going on myself.
You know, I've talked about this before, but I think all the major trends that were happening before a current president, which is artificial intelligence, you know, reshoring and reorienting your supply chains, defense spending, you know, persistent government deficits, all those were in play beforehand. And I think all that the geopolitical does is it's driven up more government spending on the defense side. So defense spending budgets have gone up in Europe, in Canada, I don't know about Mexico, but they've gone up. And as a result, that's driven a need for capital, right? And number two, the AI trend that was going before current administration, and we're just seeing the continuation of that. So I really think that the market adjustment had to get its head around what tariffs meant, and kind of has. And the geopolitical is just pushing forward issues like the reshoring of critical manufacturing, you know, that we were already going through 3 to 5 years ago.
So even though we're now in February, I'm going to use the fact that the Lunar New Year is coming up to ask you what goals do you have set for yourself? Because you've constantly changed. You're now the co-president of Carlyle. What goals do you have for yourself for this year? What would you like to see or accomplish?
I think make it more Carlyle related. I think for us, it is to continue to push out and expand the businesses that we have and be able to deliver those consistent returns that our investors expect. And so we built a very broad, diverse portfolio of products from a credit perspective so that we could purposely always move to where we thought the opportunity was. And so that's what we're doing today, and we're going to continue to do. We don't have any big growth initiatives going on. I think it's just more, you know, continuing to grow the existing businesses we have and getting deeper. I think a goal for the whole group and the whole firm is, how do we implement, you know, AI for productivity gains, but also for increased or improved decision making? And that is a big ongoing objective, you know, across the firm that we'll be continuing to push on. And as you can see, I'm very passionate about that. So I'll make sure that happens.
When you look back on your career, and what advice would you give to a young person saying, this is what has helped me succeed, besides your passion and your interest? Although maybe that is the answer.
Right. The simple answer is, whatever it is you're doing, be interested in it. Because if you're not interested, it's very hard, you know, to excel. I mean, you can be super brilliant, I guess, and you'll excel a lot of things, but it's hard to fake it if you're not really into it. So if investing in credit isn't what you're into, then you should find out what that passion is and work on that. Because, you know, everything builds on itself. And I think that, you know, I can look back over 35 years and see things that I've did. Some I've loved, some I haven't loved through my career, but they've all helped me get to where I am today. But I think in this world, like, things are much more compressed, right? Look at the rapid change of technology, but you still have to learn the basics, right? Like, you really, you know, it's hard to just plug everything into a computer and tell you how to make a credit investment. You probably should learn fundamental credit analysis, like on a spreadsheet, before you use AI to do it. So, you know, pick something you're passionate about, learn as much as you can, become expert, and recognize you don't have to be constrained by that one passion. You could decide to do something else, but whatever you've learned will build on that other thing. And at work, I always tell people, be curious, try to be innovative, you know, ask questions, push boundaries a little bit. And I don't mean authoritarian boundaries. I mean more boundaries as to how we do things and think about how you can change things and how you can make things better. Because without that, we can't move forward.
Thank you so much. This has been such a great conversation. As always, Mark, I'm really appreciative of your time and your insights.
Thanks, Lisa. I really appreciate it.
And to our audience, thank you for joining us. And do join next week for another session of Credit Exchange. And follow us on Apple and Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. This has been Lisa Lee.